Hail to you, wise one. Geb created you. The Ennead has given you birth. Horus is satisfied with his father. Atum is satisfied with his years. The gods of the east and west are satisfied with this great event, which took place in the arms of the one who gives birth to the gods. Utterance 247 of the Pyramid Text, Section 258. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I really appreciate you coming by and listening and downloading and all that kind of good stuff. Finished up June, and it was another really great month. And I appreciate you all for making that happen. So please keep liking, sharing, subscribing, all that kind of good stuff. Get the numbers up and even more. So, and that's true for new and old listeners as well. Please enjoy and continue all the kind of good stuff. So, today we're going to be covering stories the Egyptians believed about the creation of themselves, their land, the world, and indeed the very rules and laws holding all these things together. But before we start with that, though, I did want to again talk about why I am talking about this now and not next season. First, as I mentioned last week, next season, or at least what I think next season is going to be, which is still subject to change, but it will probably cover 4,000 to 3,000 BCE. During that period, two kingdoms will have been founded, if they haven't already been, before they are being united together into what we know as the Land of Egypt. This entity will have rulers using highly symbolic iconography to communicate their status, power, prestige, to the vast amount of people who, of course, can't read because writing doesn't exist yet. Hell, some of these symbols will become the basis for a decent chunk of the writing system the Egyptians developed. So I don't think it's unreasonable to think that they at the very least have some parts of this religion that are extant, at least by the end of this season. And this is also going to be a good place to compare and contrast with other urbanizing peoples and their growing religious and mythological stories. First, let's talk about the Egyptian gods in the round. This is something that we in the West, or at least in the U.S., don't learn much about. Egyptian myths and religion are not really covered in depth in primary school like the Greek and Roman myths are. You might even be wondering if you're like me and an American school student, how many gods did the Egyptians believe in? And the answer to that is no one agrees on the exact number, and some claim that they may have had as many as 3,000, others 2,000. Others claim it's a number in between those, and then some say it's 1,000, etc. Even in Egypt and among the Egyptians, it was always in flux, and there isn't a real answer. Even in terms of important gods, or gods worshipped universally, or with multiple temples across all of Egypt, or gods of trades, or tasks, or phenomena that are important to everyone. We don't have an exact number because, again, at different periods of Egyptian history, this changes as the roles and domains of the gods shift. In those instances that I talked about, you could be talking about 50 to 100 gods, depending, again, on the time frame you were looking at of Egyptian history. Now, like the Mesopotamians, like the cities of Mesopotamia, the Egyptian gods had homes in settlements. These would have been very similar in size and shape to other homes in said settlements. Sadly, we've never found one of these early shrines intact, though we have found a few partial examples in a couple of places, and reconstructions have kind of been made by combining kind of these remnants together. Now, early scholarship on Egyptian religion had a few theories on how worship of so many gods spread. One of the more popular early theories is that every village or town or tribal group, you know, if you had nomadic pastoralists or hunter-gatherers, they may have had a deity or totemic animal that they used to identify themselves. And as time went on and Upper and Lower Egypt developed and these various groups collected or adopted each other's gods in a regional pantheon to help keep the peace between their peoples, then these regional pantheons did the same thing to their bordering regions to make another, and so on and so forth, until you have the collective pantheon of Upper and Lower Egypt, and then together you have the pantheon of the United Kingdoms of Egypt. Now, this theory, you know, makes a certain kind of sense. Whatever criticism that one could make about the ancient Egyptians, they did not discriminate on a religious basis. They respected piety and would have had no issue with outsiders worshiping their own gods in Egypt or with these outsiders worshiping Egyptian gods. And they were more than open to worshiping foreign gods, especially if that god had a function that one of theirs didn't cover. Though over time, these tended to be adopted and blended into more traditional Egyptian deities. That said, anthropologists point out, especially more so as they have studied more places, that monotheism is extremely rare. And even cultures that are monotheistic generally did not begin that way. And further investigation into the early Proto-Egyptians seems to kind of back this up, at least in their case. Most of these early settlements were home to shrines for several gods, and there was overlap in some of these deities between peoples and places. Though, of course, these could have begun as different gods with the same function. Over time, one became more popular version, or they became syncretized, what have you. So, the theory of a bunch of singular settlements worshipping one deity before they combined into smaller regional territorial pantheons is generally discounted today. Of course, that being said, there was some level of competition in Egypt between various cities and their primary pantheons. Though I will point out, because it is important to remember, that they would never naysay another city's gods. They were way too pious for that. But they would maybe tell the same story, emphasizing their patron's role over the patron of another city's role in said story. And one of the biggest examples you see this in is in their creation myths. Essentially, we have today, I think we know of four main versions of the story. And these were told, at least initially, in four different cities. This is the city of Hermopolis, which to the Egyptians was Hemenu. There's Heliopolis, which is Iunu. Then you have Memphis, which is Mennefer. And then you have Thebes, which was known as Waset. The names, of course, that we know them by are the Greek names for said cities. And before I begin to dive into these different stories, or these different versions of these stories, keep in mind that there is in all of these some element of commonality. And again, we'll dive into it. But there are also periods where other parts of the story is more popular and things are kind of changed up. Sometimes there's like a cosmic egg that the sun emerges from. Sometimes there is just roiling kind of chaotic waters and all that stuff. But by and large, depending on the time frame, the myths go forward from there. Though some myths don't even emphasize that early of a creation. They emphasize more recent creations with man and humanity and all that kind of stuff. So just keep that in mind as well. So first we're going to focus on the creation myth from Hermopolis. This is probably one that may have, at least the end of it, people might be a little bit more familiar with, at least again here in the U.S. It begins with the primordial waters, which is in the Egyptian myth, it's personified as the god Nu. He's depicted, at least in later periods, with having a blue skin, and he is kind of fat, or in some cases androgynous. At least he's male otherwise, but he does have kind of large man boobs, essentially, for lack of a better word. And he is kind of, again, he's the primordial waters. This is water with no life in it. It's just moving constantly. It's just like a swirling mass that is just being spun around, just without any kind of direction or anything else. Now, that is not to say that Nu is alone, or at least he's not alone for any longer than it took him to create his consort, his sister, Nalnet. And for Egyptian names, at least for the gods, if it ends with a T, it's a goddess. So at least in this myth especially, you'll see a lot of male, female names that are almost identical, with, again, just the exception of being able to end it with a T. Now, Nu and Nalnet, eventually they give, well, I don't know if it's necessary that they give birth. It's kind of obscure what's happening. But from these primordial waters comes what is known as the Benben. And this is the initial piece of land that will become, eventually become the world, the physical land. And the Benben has been associated with a bunch of different parts of Egyptian iconography, archaeology, or not archaeology, architecture. The very tip of the pyramid is sometimes believed to have been a representative of the Benben Mound. That's like the golden cap at like the top of the, you know, the major pyramid, the big pyramid of Giza. And then other pyramids probably had like special capstones that were meant to represent the Benben Mound. And the tombs that the Egyptians had before pyramids, mastabas, these are kind of these rock, and I'll talk about it when we talk about mastabas, but it's the Arabic word for like stool or table, I believe. And essentially it's kind of like meant to represent that. It's meant to kind of cap over the earth. But after you have Nu and Nanet, you get Hehu and Hehet. And we're not really sure what their deal was, like what part they had in creation. Some people think that they were an early version of heaven and earth, but we're not really sure. Their names, when they're written, they're not really sure what the figures are supposed to represent. And eventually heaven and earth will come to be associated with other gods from other pantheons. And we'll talk about that later. But after you have heaven and earth, or Hehu or Hehet, if that is what they were, you have Kekwi and Kekwet. And they are kind of, they're more like darkness, I guess would be the best way, or like shadow might be another way to describe it. And they're kind of like the primordial gods of night or darkness. And they could have also have been a representative of day and night as well. Like it could have been like the passage between one and the other, but before the sun, at least. But again, it's debated. we're not really too sure about these two either. And as you might have guessed, the last pair we're also kind of stuck on. This is Ker and Kerhet. Though in other versions of the myth, they may be Amun and Amunet, or Nanu and Nunet, or Ni and Nit. Again, this is one of those things we're talking about where it kind of changes over time. What these two were supposed to have represented isn't really known. They could have just been another part of like that murky primordial pre-sun, pre-land, pre-humanity aspects that, you know, something deep and dark and mysterious to humanity that we, you know, trying to imagine what it was before everything began. When these four pairs are depicted, they are shown as the males are depicted with the heads of frogs, the females are depicted with the heads of snakes. Sometimes they're just completely depicted as frogs and snakes. Again, place and time. And this is known as the Ogdoad. And that just means the eightfold in Greek. And I think it's just the Egyptian, it was just eight. So the eight gods. And essentially these eight gods will eventually become the kind of the founding pairs of numerous different deities, phenomenon, that kind of thing. Or they'll give birth to the deities who then create the phenomenon. It's kind of hard to say for sure. But regardless, that is kind of like the biggest, largest scope myth of the earliest point of creation. Now, again, other stories tell a slightly different version of this, but the primordial waters are there in almost all of them. So the god Nu, essentially. Though, again, sometimes he's more, or I should say, sometimes he's less anthropomorphic than he is usually depicted on temple walls. But that's, again, probably just to show that that is who that's supposed to be. Because people may not be able to recognize the hieroglyphs for him, but they could maybe recognize his picture, such as it was. But yeah, so that's the creation myth at Hermopolis. So let's now move on to, let's move to Thebes next. So, Thebes' creation myth kind of ties in a little bit to Hermopolis, except in the case of Thebes, the fourth god in the Ogdoad is not Kera, it's Amun. Now, Amun is the patron god of Thebes, and his name means the hidden one or the invisible one. And in the earliest versions of his stories, he is married to Amunet, which, again, kind of points to him being a primordial god. His consort is someone who essentially is just the female version of himself. Though later, especially when he becomes more important and Thebes becomes a more important city, he is listed as being the consort of the goddess Mut. And they give birth to the Egyptian god Khonsu. Or Khonsu. Now, in this story, Amun is kind of, again, the hidden one, but he is kind of the force. He's the unseen spark that lights a fire, essentially, for all the other gods, all the other forces of creation, to kind of get the ball moving to the current version of the world that we live in. Now, how he did this, the story's not very clear. Some cases he makes a loud roar or a loud honk like a bird. In other cases, he makes a like a display in the sky. I've seen a couple different ones, though. Again, I'm not sure how much of these are, you know, well attested. I'm not sure if some of these just were created later to be good stories. I don't know. But there are also, to the Thebans at least, him being the Hidden One, he was unknowable. Not just to humans, but to the other gods. He was just kind of in the background, always kind of pushing things forward from behind the scenes, just kind of outside of everything else. Which, you know, again, Thebes is going to make their patron god seem very important. So, keep that in mind. Thebes, of course, is a very important city, so it would make sense that they would have a very important god, and it would make sense that stories about this god would become very, very popular. Let's see. Which one do we want to hit on next? Let's go with Heliopolis. Now, like Thebes, Heliopolis's story involves a god that was very important to them. Was their patron, and like Thebes, their creation story ties back into that story from the chaotic waters, Nu, and the creation of everything. Except in this story, the Ugadad, they're not mentioned. They may have existed, they may not have, but they're not important to this story. Because in this story, the Benben Mound, you have the god Atum rise up and basically deliver himself onto the Benben Mound. Now, depending on the story, he either willed himself into existence, or he was always existing in Nu. He was always there. He just didn't have anywhere to kind of get out and do anything on his own. He had to wait for something to emerge from Nu that he could stand on. Once there, though, Atum creates two new gods, Shu and Tefnut. Now, how he does this, again, depends on the person telling the story and the time that the story is written. The most common methods that are mentioned is that he either spit them out, or he either masturbated, and they both appeared from that act. Essentially, you know, there's this dry Benben Mound. He's there. He adds moisture and or air, and that is what creates life in Genesis. And Shu and Tefnut are the god of air and the goddess of moisture. Or at least that's what they are in this story. They had other aspects, but just keep in mind that that's where they are important in this story. And eventually those two, of course, would go on to sire many of the other gods that would appear in Egyptian mythology. Geb and Nut being their children, and then Geb and Nut, of course, being the pair that would give birth to Isis, Osiris, Seth, Nephthys, that crowd. Atum is also associated with the sun god, though he's the setting sun, whereas Re is like the sun at full power, and then you have Khepri, I think, is like the morning sun. Now, of course, over time, Atum and Re kind of get kind of merged together, and then Re just becomes out and out more popular, but Atum is still there, and he is still remembered, at least in some circles, again, for his apparent role in creation. Before I forget, though, so like the Ugadad, this gives rise to a second kind of group of gods, and this is known as the Ennead, or the Great Ennead, and this is a group of nine deities, and this includes Atum, Shu, Tefnut, Geb, Nut, Isis, Osiris, Set, and Nephthys. And I know I already mentioned them, but they're important later. But kind of they're like the kind of the council of the gods, with Atum being above them and kind of ruling over them, while they develop other facets that will begin to become important in Egyptian life later. Now, let's go ahead and finish up with the story of the Memphite creation myth. And this has been focused on another god. This is the god Ptah. He was kind of the craftsman god. And in this story, he created, not physically, it's more of a through magic or kind of good thinking and magic, I guess, together. But he essentially, with his heart and with his words, spoke several names and gave birth to the gods and essentially everything. And it's his kind of speaking that creates Atum and, you know, other gods as well. Not to mention, of course, humans, or at least in one version, it's the humans. It might be easier to kind of imagine him as thinking up plans in his head and then figuring out the right words and magic spells to say. And then as he says them, you know, it begins to create everything around it. Or from those words, I should say. Now, his Memphite creation story kind of is in a lot of ways tied into the Heliopolis creation story, where Ptah is the one kind of creating everything, but his magic spells create Atum, who then goes on to kind of fulfill what Ptah has spoken into existence. So he creates Atum, and Atum creates everything that he creates and these other gods. So Ptah is kind of like the grandfather in this situation, who created Atum. So, not mutually exclusive. And, you know, Ptah was a very popular god, I think pretty much through the entirety of Egyptian history. So, I think even people from Heliopolis, you know, they might have been fine with, you know, him trying to take some of Atum's shine, at least to an extent. But, again, there's not a lot of consistency in these stories, but the Egyptians didn't need for them to be consistent because they're trying to convey these deep ideas about how things came to be. So it's a very philosophical situation in a lot of ways. And just because they're not internally consistent doesn't mean that the Egyptians didn't recognize it. They probably just didn't care because these are just kind of explanations of the gods' role in their lives. Not, you know, this is 100%, 1,000% how it happened. It's just an idea of how it could have happened, if that makes sense. But the Egyptians, of course, you know, throughout their history, their theology, their all this stuff is changing over time. We'll talk about it more when we get there, but Horus, in most situations, he's considered the son of Isis and Osiris. But in the earliest evidence we have, Horus is actually a son of Geb, who is the father of Osiris, Isis, and Seth, and Nephthys. Horus is another son of Geb in this situation. Not a son of Isis. He's his own, like, he's a brother. He's an equal to these others. And he's kind of his own thing. It's only later that he kind of gets, not demoted, but he becomes, instead of a brother to Osiris, he's the son and successor of Osiris. And there's a little bit of evidence for this. It's very scanty because, again, it's probably almost entirely pre-dynastic where you would find this type of stuff, but some of it does kind of come down in bits and pieces. So it's not something that needs to hold up to eternal logic and consistency, because a lot of this stuff, again, the Egyptians day-to-day, most of them, never read these stories. They were only told these stories at specific times of years, for festivals, things like that. As long as everything was in good working order, they didn't really care too much about the finer points. And most of them couldn't read. And those that could read, they probably travel a little bit, especially as part of religious ceremonies, but they're not really challenging what they're reading outside of their own temples. They're not really probably diving into it too much. Now, that's not to say that no one did that. I'm sure there certainly were some, but they didn't really write down that they had any problems with it. Again, that's just kind of my take on it. And I think it's a fairly popular take. And speaking of things being in working order, that brings us to a very important concept in Egyptian cosmology, and that is the concept of Ma'at, or order. At least that's how it's usually translated. Sometimes it's something like balance or justice, and sometimes it can be all those things and maybe a little bit more. Now, Ma'at is a goddess, though she is a deification of that concept. She's a very old one, as far as I know. I know she shows up in the pyramid texts, one of the pyramid texts, so that's Old Kingdom Egypt. Sometimes she's considered married to Thoth, who is another important popular Egyptian god, but sometimes she's not. It depends, again, on the region. Pharaohs and anyone, really, who's trying to, portray themselves as a good person, try to get in the afterlife, always talk about serving Ma'at and loving Ma'at. And in some cases, they're not necessarily talking about the goddess, they're talking about the concept. Again, just one of those things where they're not necessarily different, but they're not necessarily the same thing either. But Ma'at is something that you can make an offering to, the goddess, I mean, not the concept. It's easier to go and worship a goddess than following truth and law and order and all that kind of stuff. Sometimes that might be a little bit harder than going and praising a statue in a temple. But that's just a little cynicism from the 21st century here. So Ma'at is a huge concept. We'll talk more about that later. And the order of Ma'at and the prosperity and peace it brings, how it ties into the weather, the flooding of the Nile, those type of things. I'm trying to think if there was anything else huge I wanted to talk about this week. I think actually this is probably a good stopping point. I didn't want to get too deep into the myths because, again, we are going to be going over this more in depth, especially when we actually get to the periods where this stuff is being written down for the first time. So that's going to be something to look forward to. But just keep in mind. And also, the primordial waters is a very big deal in another section coming up. But think about the creation. Did the Egyptians kind of lay out versus the ones that we're going to be talking about for other peoples later. No episode next Monday. I'm taking off for July 4th. I'm going to be traveling. And I'm just not going to have time to create notes and all the other stuff. I will be listening to things to get ready for future episodes. I'm just not going to have time to kind of collect it all and collate and get it all straightened out. But we will be back that following Monday. So you guys look forward to that. If you guys have any questions, feedback, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me via email at revpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it. You can contact me via YouTube. You can comment on any of the videos. I will see them. It may take me a little while, but I'll get there. I live stream a lot. I won't be doing it this week, but if you see me live, feel free to drop into the chat, just ask a question there. Thank you all so much for joining me again this week. I hope you all have a good rest of your day and your week, whenever you're listening to this. And if you are in the U.S. and are celebrating the 4th of July, stay safe, have fun, and I will see everyone next time. Have a good night. Peace.